Dan Erickson, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You've made a career of turning around companies and restructuring them. I'm wondering if you could give me some sense of where GM falls on that spectrum. Was it easier than most, harder than most?
Well, it's still a work in progress, first order of business. Second order of business is, although we've made, I think, good progress, if you were to make a baseball analogy, I'd say we're maybe in the second or third inning. So we have a ways to go. We're proud of how far we've come, but there's still great opportunity, and with opportunity, the associated challenges before us.
To continue with baseball, then, you guys throwing mostly strikes, or is it kind of mixed up?
Well, we've been throwing more strikes than balls, but I think we're doing better than many people thought we might be doing, and not as well as we'd like to be doing.
So what could you be doing better?
Well, one of the things that we're trying to address and improve upon is the degree of complexity within our business. There's just too much friction in terms of our product development, which manifests itself in speed to market, and that would be first order of business. And then just culturally, we've made a strong statement about putting the customer to become a customer-centric organization. I think most of the automotive industry is technically driven, manufacturing driven, and once we kind of come up with a concept, then we try to incorporate a customer's perspective, and we're trying to come at it from a slightly different perspective, not actually almost a diametrically opposite perspective. We want the customer to be first, and from everything that we see in the marketplace, whether it be design, styling trends, propulsion, advanced propulsion, and from there, and as we say here, everything starts and ends with product, and the kind of manifestation of that is that we want to design, build, and sell the world's best vehicles. But I would say central to that mantra, if you will, or that goal would be what is the market, what does the customer want, what does the customer demand?
Well, let me ask you about that. As long as we're talking about sort of mindset within the company, you have been quoted as saying you want a GM to take an attack mentality toward designing, making, and selling cars. Have you been able to do that so far?
Well, I mean, when you look at some of our new products just in the last year, the Chevy Volt, I think that people sometimes say that's a step forward. I would disagree. That was a leap forward. It was a nonlinear move within the market, and we hope to significantly ramp production here and year end, ramp it up progressively through between now and the end of the year, and then really be producing at a completely different level in 2012. We came out with the Chevy Volt. I remember I wasn't with the company or associated with the company. Prior to the bankruptcy, President Obama made a comment, why can't they build a Corolla? And I think he was talking about the American industry generally. Well, the number one car in that segment today is the Chevy Cruze. And that's a statement about a company that was largely known for trucks, large SUVs, and crossovers. Now, in a smaller down-market segment, and I don't mean down-market in terms of quality, mm-hmm. but down-market mm-hmm. in terms of size, an American company is standing number one in that segment. We introduced the Chevy Sonic, which is a segment below the Corolla that's coming out late August, early September, and we'll fill the pipeline between now and end of year. That's going to be another strong statement about a car company that's really evolved to not compete at the large, high end of the market, but really wants to compete across the board. And I think that is a manifestation of, hey, we can't be playing defense all the time. The best defense, a good offense. And that's, if you will, an attack culture that we're going to go out. We're going to not metric off of internal standards, but we're going to look for standards set by the competition, and we're going to try to exceed those.
Let me ask you this, though. For all the success you've had selling Chevy Cruzes and other down-market cars, smaller cars, don't Americans still want the big ones, the SUVs and the trucks and the pickups?
Sure they do, and I'll give you a good example. You look at Buick. Buick is what I would say kind of understated, growing premium brand. Probably had no right to expect 2 years ago coming out of bankruptcy, but Buick today is believe it or not, outsells Lexus, outsells Infiniti, outsells Acura. The only two quote-unquote premium foreign brands that outsells Buick in this country right now are Mercedes and BMW. But it's quite a statement to say that here we are 7 months into the year and Buick is outselling Lexus as a quasi-premium brand. Why? Well, the Buick LaCrosse, which is really a great midsize sedan, is just viewed. I think I drive one. It's one of the best cars on the market. And starting in August, September timeframe, it's going to become a light hybrid, if you will. We're going to put some batteries in it, and we're going to jump the fuel efficiency by 25%. So on the road, it'll make upwards of 36, 38 miles per gallon. That's a very competitive midsize sedan that's high quality. You look at the Buick Enclave. It's the fastest growing brand, Buick generally, and the Enclave is a major reason why, as a crossover in the U.S. today. Cadillac's doing well, and of course our trucks are very competitive. So we're not trying to be to compete in a segment. We're trying to attack across the board.
Since you mentioned Buick, let me take you sideways for 2 seconds. I was over in China a couple of months ago reporting a bunch of stories for the show. You can't turn around without seeing a Buick over there. How important are overseas sales, China specifically, to the future of your company?
Well, I mean, if you look at the BRIC countries, China being one of the BRIC, and then you'd also have Brazil, Russia, and India, they will comprise about 50% of the global incremental growth in the next roughly 4 to 5 years. Those four countries alone will be about a third of the total growth of global vehicle demand in the globe. So how are we doing in China? Well, we have the number one market share in China. And you're right, Buick has been a strong, strong brand in China for a number of years. But what the unwritten story is, we sell roughly the same number of Chevrolets in China as we do Buicks. It's our intention over the next 15 to 18 months to start manufacturing Cadillacs as a premium brand in China. So China is critical to the growth and development of General Motors. And the good thing about it is, because I think a lot of people get concerned, we don't export jobs. We hire where we build, and we build where we sell, because the margins are reasonably thin in the automotive industry. So you can't export too many places without having foreign currency risk. It can take your profitability very quickly. So when the Cadillacs, we produce a small number in China today, and we export a larger number to China today, but the import duties going into China for Cadillac are very high. So if we want to be to create Cadillac as a global brand, and that's one of our goals over the longer term, I think we're going to have to manufacture Cadillacs in China as well.
Let me bring it back here for a second. For the people who are listening to this, for whom General Motors represents a government bailout and the worst of the financial crisis, what can you do to reassure people that the taxpayers of this country got their money's worth?
Well, this is a complex question, but I'll do my best to try and answer it. First of all, the employees and the suppliers and our supply chain, the government essentially saved an industry. It didn't save General Motors alone or Chrysler alone. There was about a $50 billion hand extended to the company. We've paid back over $30 billion of that thus far, and as you say, the government still owns roughly a third of the company. That being said, when you look at what has happened and the progress that the company's made, we have restructured. We're making money and we're producing cash. Had the company gone into bankruptcy and stayed there for a long time, or God forbid had gone into liquidation, it's estimated there would have been roughly 1 million jobs lost. Well, that would have shown up across this region and many regions, many states within the United States, and been a strong negative. The other thing is, coming out of bankruptcy, we're the largest private pension fund in the world. We had a huge pension liability, and we've supplemented that over the last 2 years, which I think we owe our retirees as much as we can provide in this area, and we're trying to fulfill those commitments, and we've got it down by over half since we came out of bankruptcy. And I think that's a strong statement. And many of the listeners may not know this, but when companies go bankrupt, there's a pension guarantee corporation that the government has, and they have to back that up. So that would have been a liability that a lot of people don't factor into this. So it's a complex question at many different levels. So far, I think we've lived up to the hope and to the promise of the American taxpayers, and we're doing our level best to finish off that commitment and say thank you for the hand extended.
This is a little bit counterintuitive, but is it fair to say that the restructuring and the bankruptcy that you guys went through and the associated cost cutting you were able to do, is that why you're having such a good run the first 2 years out of bankruptcy?
Well, there's no question that our cost structure is much more efficient. To give you an idea, back in, I think it was 2007, the average sales rate for the industry in North America was at maybe a decade high of roughly 16 million vehicles sold in North America. It dipped to a 40-year low of roughly 10.5 to 11. In doing so, at the peak in 07, our cost structure was such that we could not make money. We were losing money. And so the concessions made, the cost taken out, concessions made by the union, our partners, UAW members, by management, our retirees, it was very difficult. It was very painful, but it was part of the process to get this company back into fighting trim. So the cost is reduced significantly. But at the same time, in a difficult economic environment, our sales this year alone are up 16-18%. So we're producing great vehicles, very competitive vehicles, not only in terms of styling and design, but comfort and fuel efficiency. I mean, this is a strong statement that General Motors has made coming out of bankruptcy, whether it be electric cars, the Volt in particular. We're working on battery electric vehicles only. We're looking at compressed natural gas vehicles, and we're advanced further down, probably 10 years, we're looking at hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. So this company is a repository of tremendous amount of intellectual property combined with today in the current time frame. We're performing quite well because of great cars. Our revenue grew by $5-6 billion or quarter over quarter in most recently reported quarter, and our profits were up 89%. So it's a combination of, again, offense. We're growing in the marketplace. We're now the number one largest vehicle producer in the world, which we lost that title for about 18 months. And our cost structure's in line, and we're producing profits and cash flow. And it's representative of the amount that we've been able to pay the American taxpayer back as well.
You know, I had a conversation with Alan Mulally on this program about 2-3 years ago before everything went south. And I asked him about market share versus profitability. And he said, oh, yeah, no, I'll sacrifice market share for profitability any day. Seems that you have an opposite viewpoint. You want market share and profitability.
We want our first priority is profitability. We'd like to get market share because we're not going to price incent, discount, if you will, to buy market share. In fact, our incentives are down year over year and are consistently below our domestic competitors, quite frankly. So that speaks about brand. It speaks about the quality of our product and the market reception of our products. But of course, if you're producing great products and it's what the market wants and they're willing to pay for it and you gain market share, that's a nice secondary consideration, because I agree with Alan. You should price for profitability or else this could be a corrosive business environment otherwise.
We have gone, as you know, from a recovering economy the past couple of months and a stable stock market to great turmoil in the markets and a recognition that maybe the economy isn't recovering as we would want. What's it like for you to run a major American industrial corporation at such a time of uncertainty?
Well, recently I said that nature abhors a vacuum and markets abhor uncertainty.
Yeah.
And there's been a tremendous amount of uncertainty, some of it man-made. But, I mean, you go back at the start of this year, we seemed to come out of the chutes out of 2010 in pretty good shape. I thought the economy looked like it was recovering. Then we have the oil spike to $100 plus per barrel. That's of particular concern to our industry. And then the tragic tsunami, earthquake and tsunami that disrupted supply chain around the globe for the automotive industry. And then, you know, this sovereign debt concern just threw a tremendous amount of uncertainty into global markets, not just in the United States. And all of this uncertainty really adds up to undermine consumer confidence. And I think the most recent economic report I saw was consumer spending was down for the first time in 2 years, which means on an individual basis, on a home, particular household basis, people are probably saving because they're a little less sure about the future. So some of the uncertainty has been created by events that just happen, overtake you. Others are man-made. At the same time, we have to plan for the worst and hope for the best. And by virtue of reducing our cost structure, our break-even point, we've been able to make money at a 40-year low, whereas before we couldn't make money at a 20-year high in terms of vehicle production in North America. And that, I think that applies around the globe. So our cost structure is in shape. We're in good fighting trim. Our balance sheet is we had $40+ billion of debt before the bankruptcy. Today we have, you know, $4 billion plus in debt, and we have roughly $40 billion, five of that being a revolving line of credit, about $35 billion in cash on the balance sheet. So we think we can sustain ourselves on a microeconomic basis. We're like any household. We think we've got some savings, and you know, we're not out buying jewelry and things like that. If you were to make the analogy to a home, we're very conscious of our cost, and so we think we're in good shape. As I say, we're going to hope for the best but plan for the worst, and our objective is not to get by, not to survive, but to prosper. But we are tied in to a large degree to the gross domestic product GDP, and on a individual country around the globe. We compete in over 140 countries around the world. This is it's a huge company, as you say.
Yeah, you've said a couple of times, though, that you're looking toward September and the rest of the year to keep up the pace that you guys have established since January. How are you going to do that when consumers aren't spending, when they're watching the stock market and saying, oh, my goodness, I have to stick everything under my mattress?
Well, I wish I was all-powerful, but obviously I'm not.
Maybe just within GM, though, huh?
Well, No, this is a team effort. It's a team game, and we've got a couple new products coming out that we think could be intriguing. We believe there is a fair amount of pent-up demand. The average fleet, the age of the average car on the road, truck on the road in the United States is at a 25, 30-year high. We know people have postponed purchasing over the last couple of years with all of the turmoil going back to the start of the Great Recession in 2008. So, as I say, we keep our break-even point as low as we possibly can. We continue to invest in new products, new development, whether it be new cars, new models, but also new propulsion, advanced propulsion technologies. And we're playing for the long run, not the next 3-4 months, but over the next 5 to 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, that's one of the things I've tried to bring to the company is to project forward to 2025 and 2050. Where do we want this company to be out 5, 10, 15, 50 years from now, so that we can be proud that this is that GM is a national champion, if you will, here in the United States, North America more generally, but to grow and to embellish our brand, our reputation on a global basis as well. That's not going to happen in the next 4 months or the next 4 years. It's going to happen over the next 25 to 50.
One of the things you've been able to do, Mr. Ackerson, as GM has gotten more profitable and begun selling more cars the past couple of years, is to hire back some of the people who you were forced to lay off as you closed plants. Do you worry that the economic weakness now might force you to rethink some of those hires?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I worry about it, everything, but I think we've been very prudent in hiring people back. And I mean, obviously, we can't control everything. And if things were to get a lot worse, obviously, we're going to have to review the bidding. But we've been cautious in our hiring. That being said, we've hired back a fair number of folks, and we've gone to double and triple shifts in some of our plants. And, of course, the question might be asked, why aren't you opening additional plants? Yeah. We want to make sure that the demand is there and sustainable. And because you open another plant, it takes a couple hundred $300 to $500 million in tooling, and that's a difficult decision to recover from. So we've been prudent, and but at the same time, we have hired folks back, and we've invested another $5.5 billion, roughly, in new plant and equipment in this country, in the United States particularly, to try to make sure that we're as efficient and as quality-based as we can be. And I think, as you say, we've made great progress, but the future is always difficult to read, and we just don't want to overextend ourselves in the current economic environment.
You know, that investment point you made is a good one, because one of the things that's been happening in the economy is that businesses aren't really investing because they're a little uncertain, just as consumers are uncertain. Step back from GM for a minute and look at the broader economy and help me understand when major companies in this economy might start investing.
Well, you know, job creation is critical to any recovery, and central to any recovery and any incremental job growth, I think, is productivity. You must be productive. And innovation. So you're going to have to invest capital to gain productivity, and you're going to have to spend on research and development to create some dimension of innovation. I think what I've been trying to do, and I think met with at least some preliminary success, is to view our industrial relations with the UAW in a completely different way. They are partners. They may be they're our employees. They're General Motors employees. They're part of the family. They may be represented by the UAW, but the UAW then is a partner. And we want to have a constructive dialogue. And, for example, you know, we're in the midst of negotiations now, but one of the aspects of that I've tried to espouse, and the time will tell if we see any real progress or success in this area, is let's not increase our structural cost and by having commitments to X percent increase in salary every year. But I think what would be good in America to incent management and labor to have a more productive, a more constructive dialogue is to say, you know, let's all pull on the same oar. We have four metrics before management gets any bonus at General Motors. I might parenthetically say the top 25 people don't get any bonus, period, because of our government ownership, and I think that's fair. It's reasonable. But for the average manager in the company, say middle-level manager, he or she is measured on four metrics, one of them being quality. And it's a composite. It's everything from J.D. Power initial quality to our warranties and whatnot. And we run a composite to measure the quality, which, quite frankly, is second to none. I mean, our quality right now, I would put against any of the foreign transplants or any of our domestic competitors. And we're proud of that, and we want to keep it. So we're going to incent our people along those lines. And what we're trying to do is say, look, if management gets a bonus, then I think our hourly people ought to get a bonus. It's, if you will, profit sharing or success sharing. And, of course, one of the concerns might be, well, how do we know you're not going to game it? Well, if we have a great year and management gets a bonus, then you'll get a bonus. And we'll argue about how to feather that in and what's the mechanism for determining the amount. But let's agree in principle on that. By the way, if we have a bad year and management doesn't get a bonus, it's very clear then the union wouldn't get a bonus. And that way we share in each other's success. We're all motivated along the same lines. And I think that would make it easier for companies to say, tech companies in Silicon Valley have a different paradigm than we do in industrial America. But this would be a way and open up a new era, I think, of more productive dialogue between management and labor and not have this great divide, but rather let's close the divide and all be on the same team and we all be incented on the same four things. I mean, going into the a bankruptcy of one portion of your employees by virtue of a union contract, and I'm not saying this has happened at General Motors, but it seems strange somebody would get in a raise, whether it be 1, 2, or 3%, while in the same time you're slashing the headcount and salaries for management. So let's all get us on the same sheet. Let's all get everybody aligned. I think whether it be on a microeconomic basis within a company or, quite frankly, on a global basis or on a national basis, I think America is known for its generosity. And quite frankly, in the past, I think we've been known for our ability to compromise and play on the same team. And that's what the environment I hope to, and the management team here hopes to create at General Motors.
Let me see if I can re-ask that same question in a slightly different way, and maybe get you away from GM and management and bonuses and labor relations. And, mm-hmm. and it's a pretty simple question. How are we going to get out of this?
Well, I think first thing you have to do is you got to get your financial house in order. You have to create a constructive economic environment. And look, there have been so many things that have happened over the last decade. And, you know, I'm not a politician, I'm not a policymaker, and I don't want to be one. But you can't, we can't run the deficits we're running. And I think both political parties and I think the President of the United States, we all agree to that. And so once you kind of get things more in balance, and I'm not a person, I don't know anything about that, but you look at everything from entitlements to stimulus packages to bailouts, and it's all got to be factored in. We've got to come up with a plan that gets our financial house in order, where the businesses of the world that are profit-oriented, that you know, are going to operate to the benefit of their shareholders, not for the necessarily the social good, although I do think there should be a component of that in any profitable and thriving company. But what you do is when you create some certainty, some predictability, where business feels that they understand the rules. If there's a new tax regime, I'd like to know what it is. Is there going to be incentive for research and development? Is there, are there job credits or not? Is there a payroll tax or not? And I'm not espousing one way or another. I just like, I want to know what the rules are going to be. Right now, I know there's this new committee that as a result of the compromise that was made, what are the rules going to be? And mm-hmm. I think we're kind of caught in this moment. There's a pause and there's a hesitancy, if you will, on a corporate perspective. What are the rules that by which we operate so we can kind of get the engine started and we can progress down the road? Right now, we're kind of standing at a red or yellow light saying, okay, when and how do we proceed and what's the speed limit? And I think it goes back to the initial part of our discussion is, you know, uncertainty is it drives people like me and our team here at General Motors to distraction. And it's not a particularly pleasant experience to try to guess what is the environment going to be a year or two down the road.
Dan Akerson, the CEO of General Motors. Mr. Akerson, thanks so much for your time, sir.
Thank you very much.